This is session number 45, recorded on June 25th, 2007. And we're finishing up the LaRouche section of my book, Fat at Communion with Bob Dobbs. And there's a long quote near the end of the LaRouche section. It's the third last quotation in the LaRouche part. And Scott already read it in the last session. And now I'm going to reread it and maybe talk about it as we work through, or Scott might have questions about parts of it. And then we'll have two more shorter quotes from LaRouche to wrap up the LaRouche section. Okay, so this quote is from 1974, the article from the Campaigner, November-December issue, that we've quoted from before. It's called Rockefeller's Fascism with a Democratic Face. And it's a quote that kind of goes into LaRouche's explanation of creativity and scientific thinking and the general principle. And it's interesting to listen to this and what he wrote in the early 70s, and then think about all the other quotes that we used that came from later writings in the 80s and 90s. So we'll see how much this one prefigures the later thinking. So it is page 85 and 86 of that issue. So here we go. The problem of scientific development in the setting of mathematical physics is a useful... Oh, yeah, I remember... Last session I was saying, now imagine him coming out and starting a press conference with this. Remember that?
Yeah.
We discussed that. So here's LaRouche explaining what should be done if he had a chance to get major media attention. So here he is. Imagine him doing this at a press conference. The problem of scientific development in the setting of mathematical physics is a useful point of reference. The most wretched fallacy which might be introduced into creative scientific work is the notion that platoons of scientists working according to predetermined specific objectives are the, quote, most efficient, unquote, mode for progress. In fact, such procedures or bureaucratic measures to similar effect are the most certain means for minimizing the gains of progress so undertaken. So we see LaRouche here criticizing the standard American cultural approach to inventing things, the group bureaucratic committee-run process.
Yeah, probably goes along. Probably it's part of this idea that, you know, there's these platonic pre-existing ideas can only be intuited by an individual. They can't be grokked by a hive mind or a group mind.
Right, and so I think that's what he tries to say in the next couple of paragraphs. Let's see what he says. The process of conceptualization by which new scientific achievements are generated is an individual activity. Bingo, that's what you just said. Not only must the thinker be afforded the opportunity to think without interruptions or other interference for protracted periods, but he must have means for, quote, toying with, unquote, experimental approaches as certain features of his individualized creative activities demand. And he has some brackets, or Scott says parentheses, demand that he delay... demand that he delay this until his duly elaborated proposal has been approved and the progress of fundamental scientific work virtually ends until such a silly bureaucratic control practice ceases. Let me read that again. So he's talking about a guy has to wait for a grant, you know, and he can't put the creative activity on hold like that. Demand that he delay this until his duly elaborated proposal has been approved and the progress of fundamental scientific work virtually ends until such a silly bureaucratic control practice ceases. End of parentheses. To all immediate practical intents, the processes of creativity are contained within the person of the thinker and cannot be reduced to an externalizable, quote, division of supervised labor, quote, form without destroying their integrity. This is not the complete picture. To the extent that self-consciousness is developed in creative personalities, there is a fruitful increase in the degree of communicability between the creative aspects of the mental processes of all involved. This is not a dissolution of several creative intellects into one larger mass, but represents a more frequent intersection through which the partial progress of one collaborator stimulates new directions of mental activities among the others. Then, in a new paragraph, he has an italicized sentence. It goes, the particular creative discovery is, in every case, the private, impassioned agony of the individual working in some degree of isolation. And that's the end of the italicized section. The activity of synthesis, which every relatively negentropic gestalt represents, is uniquely coextensive with the individual's cognitive processes, which cannot be directly merged in their primary form with the similar processes of other individuals. And he says, in quotes, interruption, unquote, and distraction, quote, unquote. So interruption and distraction are terms which traditionally express the destructive effects of intrusion into the necessary privacy of the creative process. Remember how McLuhan talked about printing press creating the solitary reader, and the printing press was the first assembly line of invention, so, or the model of the assembly line of applied knowledge. So the privacy of the creative process is something McLuhan would say is a Gutenbergian bias on LaRouche's part.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
LaRouche may be right, though. The creative individual's effort in any new undertaking begins with tugs at a few elusive clues of incommunicable prescience. It's like having it on the tip of your tongue. The thinker seldom begins with any better assurance of a definite kind of success than the certainty that the effort will be fruitful if pursued long enough with sufficient intensity of concentration. Creative discovery is, in this sense, a process of exploration of unknown territory, for which a sense of direction, broad training, and resourcefulness are the essential prerequisites. At the beginning, there can be no maps in existence of that which is to be explored, nor can one establish any meaningful schedules concerning one's intended arrival at definite new discoveries in particular. Interesting, a lot of corporations in their labs, they kind of can say, well, we'll have this done by then. They kind of come up with stuff on a schedule.
Mm-hmm.
And then Moore's Law says we get big breakthroughs every 18 months. So be interesting to see what LaRouche thought of Moore's Law or that kind of corporate inventive process.
But he did like when Kennedy said, let's go to the moon, and actually that organized a collective effort.
Yeah, he's all for crash programs.
Yeah.
But he's against bureaucratic control of the crash programs.
Mm-hmm.
During the ensuing process, the thinker's initial partial successes do not appear as definite solutions to a pre-established problem, but only as new ways of considering a problem, or the importance of a certain detour, or a new overview of the entire nature of the problem to be solved, or solutions to problems which had not been considered relevant to the original undertaking, and so on. In between each moment of articulable progress in this experience, the ongoing process assumes forms which are indispensable to accomplishment, but are not susceptible of direct social expression. Although creative work is uniquely individual in those respects, it is the most social of all activities. The development of the mental processes in preparation for creative work is entirely social. Not only are the actions impinging upon the individual's development, Not only are the actions impinging upon the individual's development social, but the content of this influence reflects the internal geometry of society. There's the geometry metaphor.
Yeah.
You know, he's talking about geometry in education, and then he applies geometry and its processes, non-Euclidean geometry, to society in general.
And did we touch on the notion last week, or that Plato's perfect forms would arise from these five Platonic solids, and that the mind of God works on geometric principles or something like that?
Yeah, yeah. The Platonic forms are, Platonic solids are archetypes and mirrors of the invisibles.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's interesting. Are they the shape of the invisibles? Or are they the sensory manifestation of them? I think they're in the interval between the two.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay, so we're at the point where... what was the last thing I said? Geometry of society. Okay, so continuing the paragraph. In fact, it is to the extent that the individual apprehends his experience in just such terms that he's orienting the results of his experience for fruitful creative efforts. Similarly, the definition of problems requiring solution is determined by social criteria, as social criteria on the broadest scale of reference determine which hypotheses represent probable insight solutions to these problems. See, that's where he brings in the political economy and what needs to be done in the society to keep the energy, population and density and all that intensely evolving.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a political context for invention.
Yeah.
He continues, the distinctive outlook of the creative thinker is associated with the extent of its scope of reference in respect to the much greater breadth of its current relevance and its historical setting. The conceptions and principles of scientific work are the accumulated accomplishment of approximately six centuries of European progress since the early period of the Renaissance. They have been evolved under the impact of changes in technology as such, and changes in the social relations through which technology is realized. That's interesting. He's talking about the social relations that technology kind of creates, and the changes it creates. It's slightly McLuhan's medium as a message point, but he's not going to fetishize it like McLuhan did. He then says, Luce says, the characteristic interchangeable terms of creative effort are, quote, universal, quote, fundamental, and, quote, revolutionary. So, any thoughts on this?
He doesn't like bureaucracy, but he's looking for, greater population density. And anytime you get a bunch of people, you know, he seems to have this belief, which I don't necessarily agree with, that the good, the true, and the beautiful are self-evident. And that if anybody, you know, that if everybody, you know, this dense population mass of human beings follow his protocol for education, that everyone will see the good, the true, and the beautiful as self-evident, that it's objective, and everybody will agree that it's true, and there won't be any arguments among human beings. And the fact of the matter is, you put five human beings in a room together and try to get them to agree on anything, and you've already got a bureaucracy, and I don't see that, you know, that it's reasonable to think that that can be avoided.
Right. That's why LaRouche is an elitist, in a sense. He says, the masses don't know anything, and you only have a certain number of people that understand the process, and they need to manage society and be the people that determine which technologies are the ones you go for.
Yeah.
And as the society becomes more successful along LaRouche's plan, then there's more educated people, and then it's like you say. But
he's basing this all on the idea that there is a fundamental self-verifying, objectively true, self-evident knowledge and wisdom, and anyone who goes through the process will agree that I see this is the way it works. We can all agree, we can all work together, and I don't know that's actually true.
Well,
I mean, for instance,
remember your example, I just want to say this, is that if you know, you get to really familiarize yourself with what LaRouche says over the years, he's always talking in general principles, and the general principles are what society claims to be doing already. He says we have to stay on topic about developing technology. Now, Hillary Clinton says that, George Bush says that. Actually, they're very general principles he's always falling back on. It's just that he has all this complicated talk within it that obscures the normalcy of his principles. And he says Al Gore, when he starts saying everybody should concentrate on global warming and deal with that, that's an erroneous principle. So you could do all your propaganda against Gore, and LaRouche is doing that now, because that distracts us from the principles we've always known for 600 years.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to say that. Okay, so what were you saying?
Well, if all scientists, you know, I think he presumes that if all scientists around the world in their own separate laboratories were all working on the hypothesis of the higher hypothesis, they would all arrive at the same objective truth. And,
I don't think he says that. He says it's an ongoing exploration. Like he's even saying a thinker, a scientist here doesn't even know what he's working towards. He has an idea and he doesn't know what he's going to find.
Right, but if he finds what's true, he will find the same thing as the next guy. I think he believes that there are these universal truths.
Oh, wait a minute. No, here's what I... You're triggering off the point. It's not that truth, beauty, and what's the other one? Truth, beauty, and...
The good, the true, and the beautiful.
Oh, yeah. That they're images that you worship. He says the process is what's important, and you stay focused on the principles, they're not, you don't worship the principles, and what you find is only a way station. So I think you're symbolizing or turning into an iconography, because when push comes to shove, you'll see in these quotes we've been going through all these months, he's always deflating the emphasis on what is assumed to be true. He's always saying we don't go to the root of axioms and assumptions.
Yeah.
So, but in his organization, they write journalistic articles and essays, and they title them Truth, Beauty, and the Good and all this stuff. But you actually find out that the whole point of the article is to argue with those that say they know what truth and beauty is, and LaRue says you can't know. It's an ongoing discovery. So it's actually the kind of stuff maybe a university president would say. They didn't allow any course topic to become a cult.
Well, I've been kind of assuming that LaRouche believes there are these sort of divine ideas in the mind of God, and it's up to us through following the procedure of the hypothesis or the higher hypothesis to discover and anchor them in our own mind and bodies.
No.
But they're pre-existing ideas in the mind of God.
Hold it, stop that point there. Remember, what he's saying is you have no evidence that you're on the right track unless you've got concrete technological products and the population is getting denser. That's how you determine whether you're successful or not. Mm. It's not an iconic philosophical category of truth, beauty, or whatever, or the good.
Right.
You have to manifest it in concrete forms, and you're tending to interpret it as principles that abstractly he will come to.
Yep.
He says that's almost the Aristotelian method. Looking for a formula that you then have everybody memorize. Okay, so that's what he always says. You do not know that you're on the right track unless you have external technological evidence of its effects.
Right.
And the main effect, a very broad standard, is your population is getting more dense.
Well, it's kind of like if I have a compass, and I'm in the wilderness, and I head for the north. I don't know what I'm going to find there, but I know that there's a north and that there's something that's already there, and I'm going to discover what it is.
He's not into that kind of discovery. He's into you staying and not going north and working out with the materials you have to make a better energy device or better materials or a better machine tool so that your factory in the area you live in works better.
Well, does he believe you're creating something from nothing?
I don't know about that. Something that might be irrelevant.
In other words, are you bringing into manifestation new ideas that never existed in anywhere in the mind of God or in the archetypal forms of Plato? Or
he would not go so far to say those words. He would just say, "Yes, we're creating new things."
Yeah.
And this is what we made.
Yeah.
And he would show it. So it's almost like.
He wouldn't like Gurdjieff, but Gurdjieff believed that there was objective.
No, he talks about Gurdjieff and Rasputin and those guys as very evil.
Yeah.
They screwed up the Tsarist regime there and created the poverty of administration by the Tsar that led to the Russian Revolution.
Right.
He blames that on Rasputin, but Rasputin comes out of the same tradition as Gurdjieff.
Yeah.
He doesn't like Krishnamurti.
Well, like, for instance, Gurdjieff.
He doesn't like William Irwin Thompson.
Yeah. Right.
And he wouldn't like Ken Wilber. What were we going to say?
Well, does he think, you know, like Gurdjieff would say there's something called objective art. He would say, look at the pillars and the architecture in Rome that's been there for 1,000 years, and there's something intrinsically beautiful about it, and it's objectively true. They discovered some objective truth, and they brought it they carved it out of stone, and they stayed there for 1,000 years. Because they found objective art, they discovered objective art.
Now that's Aristotelian categorization and developing a formula.
Uh-huh.
He says those societies, what have they accomplished? Nothing. They worshipped their art for 1,000 years and remained static and oligarchically controlled.
Yeah.
So you look around in society and see how many people are educated and fed and productive and making new technologies, industrial technologies, or new kinds of industrial technologies, that's how you judge it. You don't go by worshiping images of art. That's iconology.
Yeah.
So I was going to say that he's like a union guy, head of a union, you know, Teamsters 105, and he has an ability to talk in philosophical terms and cancel out all of the philosophical curricula that students and the sons and daughters of the union members are learning in their oligarchically controlled universities.
Yeah.
So he's on the street saying we must stay with the task at hand and not be distracted by Gurdjieffian, and he would call it speculative Freemasonry.
Mm-hmm.
It's speculative. That's British liberalism. Aristotelianism is speculativeness. So he doesn't, he would say probably if you thought Platonism was a speculative act, cognitive act on the archetypes, then that's a British Aristotelian distortion of Platonism.
Mm-hmm. What about Watson and Crick's discovery of DNA? Did he think that was cool?
I don't know. I haven't read much on that. He might. There might be some articles over. I don't even know if their magazine, 21st Century Science and Technology, is on the stands anymore. I haven't seen it. So, and I don't have every issue. I got a lot of the issues over the last 10 years or whatever. I don't know if there's much on DNA. I haven't noticed that. But I don't read them religiously.
Yeah.
I collect them, and then sometimes I might go look at them. But they're pretty dense articles. There might be something on DNA in there. But he might say having a model like that and worshiping it is a problem. He really discounts most of the imagery that people have about science.
You know, Michael Shields is reading a book on the mathematics, the sort of history of math, and the guy who wrote the book is writing from the point of view that math does not, the world does not actually operate on mathematical principles. Our brain is structured in such a way that we develop math because our brain likes to work with it as a way of modeling the world around us, but it actually has nothing to do with the way the world objectively works around us. I wonder if LaRouche would agree with that.
Well, LaRouche is not for algebraic speculation. So if the guy is talking about that kind of mathematics, then LaRouche would agree with him. But the way you defined it, if you're right, he would agree with the guy,
yeah,
is that you don't get stuck working out abstract mathematical formulas. You must always go back into the lab, redo experiments that led to breakthroughs, see where they lead, and maybe get some new ideas on your own. You're always practically in the lab.
Mm-hmm.
That's the point. And he says if you want to be inspired, listen to Beethoven, Mozart, in the classical tradition, or listen to watch great plays, because you're an ongoing union guy fighting against the owners of the system and their oligarchical tendencies. So you're also out in the street making sure that oligarchy isn't consolidated.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why you're looking at Shakespearean plays and Schiller plays and reading classical poetry to be inspired to continue the fight in the streets for the union.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not. But now he finds the unions themselves are controlled not only by mafia figures, organized crime, but that's a minor thing. He just talks about the principles that the Lane Kirkland and these guys in the 80s and 90s were running the unions with, the general AFL-CIO, and those principles merged with the British intelligence. And so the unions, he thought, were not doing their work and therefore were crumbling because they didn't have the right principles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the principles are spelled out in all these quotes, but not anybody is likely to understand them, unless they take a lot of time to learn it. But when you actually figure out what he's saying, he's just talking about the general standards of technological society.
Mm-hmm.
Or a healthy, maybe liberal society, one that encourages the building of hospitals and bridges and infrastructure and all that stuff, which apparently the neocons, according to LaRouche, aren't for. And so America's collapsed over the last 25 more years.
Right. Now, one thing that might be interesting to juxtapose McLuhan against LaRouche here, because we're talking about what this is, and maybe this is why you included it at the end of your LaRouche section of the book. He's talking about the creative process.
Yeah, the drama of cognition is
McLuhan. Right. So McLuhan referred to, he said that our extensions of ourselves, our media environment, was recapitulating the drama of cognition and recognition, or the stages of apprehension.
Now, we're looking here at what LaRouche thinks the drama of cognition is, and they're really not the same thing at all.
Very far apart. Remember, LaRouche has called McLuhan a technological fetishist, a media fetishist,
yeah,
a total Aristotelian looking at the sensory life and how technology mimes the sensory life and getting embedded in that and looking at symbolic correspondences and metaphors, the very thing LaRouche is against.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, let me just say this. Vico was a big influence on Joyce, and Vico is a big influence in McLuhan's Laws of Media book, or at least they deal with Vico, who was a professor of rhetoric in Italy around, like, 1600s into early 1700s. This was a thinker that McLuhan and Joyce worked with. Doesn't mean they followed him religiously, but they thought he was on a useful track. And Vico is seen as a evil guy by LaRouche because Vico is in the school of rhetoric, which is Aristotelian sophistics, sophistry.
Right.
So, you know, the tradition, remember, LaRouche
is... back in the beginning of our talk a year and a half ago, we laid out that LaRouche was the rhetorician. That LaRouche is the dialectician. McLuhan was the rhetorician.
Yeah.
And Thompson was the...
grammarian.
Yeah, and then Croker, the anarchist. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so...
And those categories are very temporary, you know. They're more than that. And but just for juggling here.
Yeah. So when McLuhan... Because I want to relate this back to LaRouche, but when McLuhan talks about the drama of cognition and recognition.
Remember, if you look at the quotes we did from McLuhan, around that section of McLuhan, he talks about the senses and the mimetic process. It's all about miming.
Yeah.
And how Aristotle, he even talks about Aristotle had the key that Joyce built on. But go ahead.
Okay. So in some parts, Marshall refers to the drama of cognition and recognition. In other places, he refers to the stages of apprehension. Is he talking about the same thing, or are those different subjects?
No, it's the same thing. The stages of apprehension is how your senses imbibe the world. The drama of cognition is the drama of your senses taking in the external data, individualizing it, flipping it, and then remaking the image in resonance with the world that was presented to you.
Mm-hmm.
So McLuhan says there is already a pre-established harmony between you and the world, or that you wouldn't be able to connect with it to play with it.
Right.
In your process of cognition. And it's the drama of cognition and recognition. You say cognition would be the sensory data coming into you through your senses, and then the recognition is you remaking it, fitting it with your sensory makeup, and then the compromise in that process is what you see.
Yeah. Now, wouldn't LaRouche say that you have to go through the drama of cognition and recognition in order to make observations in the laboratory and turn those observations into hypotheses and then the higher hypotheses? Or is he looking at a different, completely different process?
Well, in his early writing, he talks about the central process. He does say it's a central process. It's not just abstract thinking. But he doesn't make a big deal about that, and he includes, complementarily, the abstract thinking processes.
Yeah, so when you're going for the hypothesis of the higher hypothesis, it doesn't matter. You could be in an isolation tank. You're not using sensory awareness at all. You're involved in the abstract world of cognition and ideas.
That's where you get limited by his categories that you apparently think he's saying, and he does say that. But remember, it relates to who's running the union and how much money and drug dealing they're doing. And you're not in a sensory tank. You're dealing with the political economy, too.
Yeah.
So it's embedded in a political reality. That's what this last part of the quote says.
So for LaRouche, there is a ratio between cognition and between political processes.
Yeah, he's in the interval, too.
Yeah.
He has a version of the interval, if we want to use that category.
But so he's looking at a different ratio. Marshall's looking at the ratio of the ratio among the proportion of the senses, and
sticking with this, it's like he's emphasizing the senses.
Yeah.
And McLuhan and LaRouche does not fetishize the sensory process.
No, he fetishizes the
the
abstract process.
Yeah, but that is a process of a ratio among the sensory cognition of political processes and the abstract cognition.
That's right. He's actually doing a ratio, too.
Yeah.
In different terms. As a matter of fact, that's what's interesting. The more you understand these guys, they kind of saying the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But they're cultural reference points and their historical heroes and the semantics that they talk about or develop are so different.
Yeah.
And so the juggling of reality by the oligarchy that LaRouche sees, in Coker's terms, is juggled by the chip body or the android meme or a virtual reality. And it's almost the same debilitating process they both see, but in different terms.
Right.
It's like getting your five people in the room, and they would never agree on what should be done.
Right.
LaRouche, he would say, Coker, you need to run for mayor of Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
And Coker says, I'm not going to waste my time. That's a bunch of TV advertisement.
Mm-hmm.
And LaRouche says, no, we get you in there. We can change that process. And Thompson would say, nah, I'm going to meditate. And McLuhan would say, well, I'll study the ads that Coker uses and show how they reflect other effects in our Android meme society.
Mm-hmm.
And LaRouche would say, McLuhan, you can leave the room. You're going to be useless if you do that.
Mm-hmm.
So yet they're all talking about an interesting tyranny that's going on.
Yeah. I wonder what LaRouche's critique of... I saw this movie last night called Failsafe, 1964, and it's about they point out they're in... It takes place in the war room, in the White House, and in the Pentagon. And what's happened is they got satellites monitoring bombers, monitoring thermonuclear loaded submarines. They're watching the global military technology. They have all these fail-safe mechanisms built in, but they're beginning to... You've got the political strategist, you got the president, you got the general who's got these, you know, a little more heart-centered or humanitarian or moral-centered. They're all arguing about each other with each other because they're saying that the mechanisms built into the technology are beginning to operate at a rate faster than man's cognitive ability to actually juggle with incidences. And they have an incident where
hold that thought there. So McLuhan would say yes to that. The environment is beyond any human's management capabilities, and there's too much information, so people resort to mythical thinking, which is on some level insubstantial. Croker would say, yes, there's a hyper speed up. LaRouche would say, yeah, we got to ignore all that speed up and get back to hardware.
Yeah. Well,
so I just would say, yeah. At that point, you're saying that it's getting out of control. Here's what I wanted to say. About LaRouche, he would say that the video games are causing serial murderers.
Hmm.
He says that about the Virginia Tech thing. They testified recently in Congress, the LaRouche people, saying this guy was a product of the video games.
Yeah.
So it's slightly McLuhan-esque.
Yeah.
Okay, what were we going to say?
Yeah. Well, so you got the White House, the Pentagon, and the War Room, and all three of these institutions have a different point of view about what to do about this crisis which has developed. The crisis being that our technology... is interfacing the Soviets' technology because we've got bombers flying just on the edges of their airspace, ready to move in the event that war should break out. Well, our technology and their technology create a synergy where neither the Soviets, where something starts getting out of control, and neither the Soviets or the United States know who's doing what anymore, whether or not one side is being aggressive against the other, or whether there's a synergy going on between their machine and our machine that we can't account for and can't understand, and the whole thing is building up into, like, nuclear proliferation and warfare.
Okay, so they're intuiting or dealing with the fact that technology takes on a life of its own.
Yeah.
And so you can see LaRouche deals with that, McLuhan deals with that, Kroger deals with that, and Thompson deals with that intuition that things are out of control technologically.
Yeah.
And there you're talking about this movie focuses on one particular effect of that.
Right.
So what happens next?
Well, what happens is that, a disaster occurs, and it's, the ultimate human tragedy.
Oh, it has a bad ending.
Yeah.
Well, that's Dr. Strangelove has a similar thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, so why do you bring that in? What's your point?
Well, I'm wondering, what LaRouche thinks about the management of technology, about the fact that we are creating technology that is, would he say, well, I mean, what does he say? We should just roll that technology back and take it off, disassemble it and do something else? Or, I mean, it's here now, the automation, the chip body automation of technological development. How does he cope with that? What does he say we should do about it?
He says you should negotiate with your allies and form. Right now, he's advocating, I think it is India, China, Russia, and I guess the United States to team up against the oligarchs in Britain who are creating a potential nuclear war in the Middle East. So it's a ongoing political alliancing so that you stop any reason to have the war, but you're saying the technology is ignoring whatever humans think they're doing in negotiating and diplomacy and creating problems regardless of the diplomacy, right?
Yeah.
So what will LaRouche say about that? He'd say turn it off. I'm not sure what he would say.
He might agree with Marshall. turn it off.
Yeah. I don't know. He doesn't seem to talk about those kind of technological Android meme crises. He keeps thinking in terms of humans can manage a situation if they have their eye on the ball of correct principles.
Mm-hmm.
And so he would say build more nuclear plants.
Yeah.
Now, so he also doesn't like science fiction. So this kind of science fiction speculative movie is irrelevant.
Yeah.
It's only a movie. It's not happening.
Yeah.
So that's my buddy.
But the movie was actually based on a scenario that could happen or might have happened.
But that's speculative science fiction, so it's not relevant.
Yeah.
It's not what's happening. The more important thing is to make more machine tools and to create the factories and the nuclear plants that allow that, nuclear power plants.
Yeah. Well, for LaRouche's institution to work, he basically would have to, I think, raise the moral integrity of the average person on this planet by about a factor of 10.
Well, how would he'd do that by giving them jobs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Practical jobs and discouraging them watching video games.
Yeah.
But that's not moral.
I'm sure. I imagine.
That'd be perceptual integrity.
Yeah.
Or attention integrity.
Yeah. No,
where you put your attention.
That's a good answer. I imagine most of the violence and crime on this planet occurs due to the fact that people's basic needs aren't being met. So if they can't have a job and raise a family and do it the way that people like to do it when they are given those opportunities, then they're going to rip, steal, and vandalize or whatever they have to do.
Yeah. So LaRouche says that the population has gone mad. The gods or the oligarchs have gone mad, so the people have gone mad because it's obvious what should be done, and you read their editorials over the last 25 years. I keep wondering why they are bemoaning the fact that nobody listens to LaRouche and gets back onto the practical principles.
Yeah.
But he's overlooking the media deluge, the media flood that doesn't allow anybody to focus on those industrial aspects, at least in their daily experience.
Yeah. So
what, I got emails I got to answer.
Yeah, does he think Bush is a dupe of the oligarchy, huh? Of England. He
yes,
still thinks England's running the show.
Yeah, England. Well, the oligarchy, not the English. The financial oligarchy has a big stake in the city of London.
Yeah,
and is in New York and Wall Street and over the whole world.
Yeah, so he believes in this, what you would consider to be obsolete system of financial economics. Like you don't believe in money. Croker doesn't believe in money anymore, but apparently LaRouche does.
That's right. Well, LaRouche would stop tax derivatives, which is a big part of the digital economy.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, he would turn off the computerized economy to the extent that it was running the show.
Yeah.
And return it to maybe administrative levels. But you can see there's a naivety. There's a irrelevance to this way of thinking. And that's why most of the population has gone nuts and gone religious and joined a cult, a right-wing, left-wing, fundamentalist religion or Christian or Muslim or whatever, all kinds of crazy reactions in people, getting drug addicted or just consuming media. It really is a wacky situation. And so Croker comes in and says, yeah, you look at this situation, this extreme madness has taken over. It looks like technology has dispensed with humans.
Mm-hmm.
And LaRouche is still talking as if humans have a say in the matter.
Mm-hmm.
And McLuhan is not as extreme as Thompson, as Croker. And then Thompson, he says, go do yoga, retreat, run away.
Yeah.
In a way, form a new age organic farm and all that, though he wouldn't allow himself to be categorized as simple solutions, but he seems to be advocating. Thompson does say there's a singularity, and he admits there's a chaos that no one can handle. But he thinks we could move into a better scene. He's optimistic about the singularity, though not ignoring the dark age. Thompson says we're going into a dark age, which will be a couple of hundred years. No way to stop it. There's always a dark age after a big breakthrough.
Mm.
So that's Thompson, all right? Dark age. And
we don't know
that we already were in a dark age.
Yeah, it depends on
you. And LaRouche says we're in a dark age.
Right.
And Croker says we're in a world of virtual reality under a dark sign, is the way he says it.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
And you listen to your Art Bell and George Nuri on Cloak on Coast to Coast. There you get the average person's apprehension and intuiting of what McLuhan, LaRouche, Thompson, and Croker precisely talk about.
Mm-hmm.
In a sophisticated way, where the average person just feels upset. So you'll hear people calling in and talking about, well, when's the end time? When's the apocalypse going to happen, or the Armageddon, or when are we going to go into a concentration camp? This is their average level of concern, right?
Well, among that demographic that listens to that show.
Well, you can read letters to the editor of the Washington Post or other things, and there's always people panicking or expressing dire panic about the situation. It's there. Most people are ignoring it by watching American Idol, but they feel it.
Yeah.
So it becomes which model, which meme are you going to use to communicate to other people your panic via? Which model meme are you going to identify with? I mean, you hear George Nuri talk about 2012. They're really looking forward to 2012. And they oscillate between a breakthrough coming at that point or a disaster.
Right. Or if you're a Christian fundamentalist, both, you're going to heaven and everybody else is going to hell.
Yeah. So Finnegan's Wake comes in, and that's a big part of McLuhan's vision, and shows all these memes yelling and screaming like the Tower of Babel, and sort of looks at it as the human comedy.
Mm-hmm. All times and places are happening all at the same time.
Yeah, and then McLuhan says that we can use any event from that. It's like our repertoire, and we can replay them, any event we want from all that inventory of all times and spaces.
Mm-hmm.
So you get a new scene every day,
mm-hmm.
which comes through the word that makes the market. And then that's for the centralized TV body. But then you got all kinds of scenarios on the Internet that people can read about, all kinds of millions of news stories. So they live in those ones each day.
Right. Well, you know, sometimes you take the extreme position that McLuhan, with respect to his Catholicism, is actually being a performance artist. I wonder if LaRouche is actually at the point where he sees himself as, like, I'm never going to get any traction with this thing, but I'm going to keep it going because I'm a performance artist and I want to keep this meme alive.
Yes, they're all performance artists, you're saying.
Yeah.
And I remember talking to the Evergreens about LaRouche once, and they said, he's got his money, and he's okay, you know. As long as he's got his money, he'll keep doing what he's doing. So he has to be a paid performance artist.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the funny thing about him and his concern about the oligarchy, you know, here he probably, in relative terms, is like the oligarchy compared to a lot of the street kids that are working for him, living on the street and handing his magazines out on the street.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't have his wealth or
And he thinks by getting them to protest at, I don't know, G8 things or congressional hearings, he's always in his magazine talking about the LYM, LaRouche Youth Movement, shows up and tests and influences the event somehow by protesting or presenting some intelligent proposal, so-called intelligent proposal, and they're kind of like pests. And he thinks that's good. He thinks he'll claim that they're influencing a lot over the last 7 years.
Yeah.
And a lot of other people would not think, a lot of other institutions would think that's not really productive.
Yeah.
So we really come down to who thinks what's important.
Yeah.
And that's what I call a mythic stage. A mythic stage is the media.